coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The latest episode of the Delaware Humanities A More Just Delaware podcast focuses on the state's paid family and medical leave law.
At the end of the day, I do not believe that in the most developed and the wealthiest nation on earth, that time and that ability to get care, that little bit of breathing room for the inevitable challenges of life, I don't believe that should be a matter of luck. I believe it should be the law of the land.
We hear from the law's architect, State Senator Sarah McBride, on the podcast. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also meet the new director of the George Reed House and Gardens in History Matters. Plus, Enlighten Me highlights stories from University of Delaware student journalists. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you another episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. The podcast examines pivotal moments in legislation related to hate, prejudice, and the fight for equal rights in Delaware. In this fifth episode, we focus on paid family and medical leave legislation passed and signed in Delaware in 2022. It makes providing leave of up to 12 weeks mandatory for most businesses with 10 or more employees. State Senator Sarah McBride was the prime sponsor of the bill and a driving force in getting it passed. McBride joins this episode to discuss the law, the work to pass it, and its anticipated impact. So let's start with a quick overview for those who may not be completely familiar with the Delaware paid leave law. Can you give us kind of a brief sketch of what it will provide when it gets up and running?
Sure. The Delaware Paid Family and Medical Leave Program, which was established through the Healthy Delaware Families Act passed by the Delaware General Assembly in 2022, will provide up to 12 weeks of wage replacement for Delaware workers who are out on leave to welcome a child into their family, to struggle through a serious illness, to take care of a family member struggling through a serious illness, or to adjust to the deployment or return from deployment of a family member in the military. This is a critical social safety net program that the overwhelming majority, essentially every other developed nation, has established, and now 10 other states plus Delaware have adopted within their own legislative process. I'm really excited as the program builds out. It'll start providing benefits to eligible Delaware workers in 2026. But this is the single largest expansion of the social safety net in modern Delaware history, and it'll provide that little bit of peace of mind through this insurance program for Delaware workers as they face the inevitable challenges and hardships of life, from joys to the fear of an illness.
Let's kind of work our way to how we got here. And I guess where I'll start is with the state itself, which dipped its toes in this area when it offered a version of paid leave for state workers in 2018. How important do you feel that was in providing a sense of what paid leave looks like, how it works, and perhaps laying the groundwork for expanding it out to the entire population?
Sure. Well, there's different types of leave, and there's different qualifying events. The state of Delaware for years has provided what essentially we often refer to as short-term disability or short-term medical leave to their workers. Then in 2019, to your question, the state expanded their leave policy to include parental leave, up to 12 weeks of parental leave for state employees. But of course, we know that state employees are just a fraction of the overall workforce in Delaware. And unfortunately, the private sector was continuing to lag behind when it came to providing these life-saving benefits to their own employees. Some of that was just because there was not an interest by some employers to provide this benefit. For some, it was also, it just was not economical to provide this benefit on their own. That's why this type of policy that we've established through the Healthy Delaware Families Act helps to actually make this benefit more affordable and accessible, not just for workers, but for the employers who otherwise might struggle to afford it on their own. But it was an important step when the state provided parental leave benefits to their employees. It led by example. It demonstrated that these are benefits that are in demand, that an increasingly competitive employee market demands employers provide, these types of benefits. And so it certainly laid the foundation among the General Assembly and among, I think, the larger economy, that these are benefits that if you want to compete, you should and you really must provide.
Following up on that, before introducing the bill, you held a series of roundtables to discuss the concepts with the public up and down the state. How did they help inform the bill that you wound up introducing, and how much influence do you think it had in garnering some of the initial support the bill needed, particularly from several business interests, including the state chamber, which a lot of times were opposed to even considering something like this?
Sure. Well, the bill was a multi-stage process. A bill this large requires conversation. I introduced the original version of the Healthy Delaware Families Act in May of 2021 with a coalition of around 40 organizations that were in support, from labor unions to healthcare advocacy groups to faith communities. But the next year was that iterative process where we held those town halls that you referenced. And in addition to those town halls with mostly supporters, I also held roughly 200 hours of meetings with stakeholders on all sides of the issue. People who agreed with me, and frankly, just as importantly, people who disagreed. I met with chambers up and down the state, local chambers, county chambers, and of course, as you mentioned, the State Chamber of Commerce. And through that statewide dialogue, I made a series of compromises. Now, I have always said that I believe that the original version of Senate Bill 1 of the Healthy Delaware Families Act was the gold standard, was the best policy we could have adopted. But governing requires compromise. And for legislation like this, which requires through the state constitution a supermajority in the Delaware General Assembly, I believed it was important to attempt to build as broad of a coalition as possible to guarantee that we could move this legislation and, frankly, move it as quickly as possible, since this benefit was long overdue. And so during that process, I made several compromises, introduced what we call a substitute version of the legislation. And as you alluded to in your question, that final version of the legislation resulted in a coalition that wasn't just those 40 to 50 organizations that supported the bill at the start. It also added the State Chamber of Commerce, and ultimately was able to achieve a bipartisan supermajority in the Delaware General Assembly.
Was there one or two of those compromises you felt were particularly crucial to getting that supermajority coalition pulled together?
Sure. So there were two elements, I think, of the changes that were particularly relevant. One was that instead of having this program automatically apply to businesses of all sizes, something I still believe is right and something that the 10 other states that have adopted this have done, we did not automatically include a certain number of small businesses under 10 employees for parental leave, and small businesses under 25 employees for medical or family caregiving leave. That change, I think, was a major factor in securing business support for the legislation. Similarly, many of these employers of 50 employees or above, were already used to working under the federal FMLA law, which ensures that workers are able to access up to 12 weeks of job-protected unpaid leave for those qualifying events I mentioned at the start. Those employers had gotten used to those rules and those regulations. And so we tied many of the eligibility criteria, many of the regulations that would be promulgated under the law to the federal FMLA to ensure that there was consistency between federal and state rules.
Was that the biggest concern you ran into in terms of opposition, was the impact on specifically small businesses, particularly coming out of the pandemic at a time when there were strong inflation worries? Was that maybe the biggest angst you saw from those who are opposing this bill?
Sure. I think there was concern around the impact on the small business community. Now, let's be clear. A lot of small businesses supported the original version of the legislation, including, for instance, Brouhaha, which understood immediately. Elisa Markaitis, the founder and CEO at the time of Brouhaha, understood immediately these benefits are in demand. And the most cost-effective way for a smaller business to provide this benefit is through the public option state insurance program, which the legislation creates. But there were some stakeholder groups, some business associations who had concerns. And so we did make those changes at their behest. They wanted a larger exemption. We landed on 10 and 25. But what I will say is we have the benefit of not being the first state to do this, which means we know what the experience is in other states. And in the states that have adopted similar policies that apply to businesses of all size, in the largest state, for instance, that has this, the state with the benefit the longest as well, 90% of employers say that their paid family and medical leave program had either no impact on their business's bottom line or a positive impact on their bottom line. And small businesses were even more likely than larger businesses to say that the program had a positive, not just neutral impact on their bottom line. In Jersey, 66% of small businesses said that the paid family and medical leave was a boon for their small business, was incredibly helpful, and that they had very positive views of the program. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, because paid family and medical leave laws like this, they don't create life events. People have life events and inevitably have to take time off work for those life events. And for a smaller business that doesn't already have these types of private insurance programs, because frankly, they can't afford it at the rate that the private marketplace offers it at. For a small business, let's say you're 30 employees, let's say you're 20 employees. An employee comes to you as a small business owner, and we always hear, rightfully, small businesses are like family. They come to you and they say, I have cancer. I have to undergo chemotherapy and radiation for 4 weeks. Unless you're lacking in compassion, that small business owner will say, well, of course, you have to take time off. Even though I'm not at that point legally obligated because I'm under that FMLA federal limit, but of course you need to take this time off. And of course you're going to need to pay your rent or your mortgage or put food on the table. So I'm going to continue to pay you your salary. Well, under this paid family and medical leave program funded through a fraction of a percentage payroll contribution split between the employee and the employer, rather than that unpredictable cost that they can't factor in at the beginning of the year when they're making their budgets, but they feel compelled to do, and they still have to pay that employee's wage out in some portion, if not it's an entirety, because they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart. Now they have this predictable, minimal cost for the payroll contribution. And then ultimately, when that employee is out on leave for any of those qualifying events, instead of feeling the need to continue to pay that employee's salary, the employee goes onto the insurance program, which provides partial wage replacement, and the employer is then able to retain that wage, either something they save or utilize that retained wage to hire a replacement temporarily, to pay overtime for someone else who has to fill that role. Ultimately, it all either comes out in a wash or, again, even if it comes out in a wash, because of that greater predictability of cost is a benefit for the small business. And so I have never ever doubted that the original version was great for small businesses, great for big businesses, great for employees. But ultimately, you know, we don't get all that we want in the legislative process. And, you know, we can always come back and have a conversation at a later date around, you know, restoring elements of the original law. But the version that passed had to include that, I believed, in order to get the support necessary, and that a big step forward, even if it's not everything we want, is an important step.
Senator McBride, this podcast is focused on efforts to combat prejudice and fight for equal rights. And I suppose some might not immediately see how paid leave fits. How do you see it connecting with this overarching theme of equity and equality for Delawareans?
Sure. First off, we have to separate the false distinction in our policies and our politics that separates issues into economic issues and social issues. You cannot have equality for all if you have an economy that only works for the few, but you also can't have an economy that works for everyone if even one person is kept out of a job because of prejudice or discrimination. So all of these issues are inextricably linked. But when it comes to paid family and medical leave, a couple of things I would say. The first is that we used to lead the world in women's workforce participation. But over the last three decades, as the rest of the world has caught up in what we call our care infrastructure, including with policies like paid family and medical leave that allow people for whom caregiving responsibilities disproportionately fall, that allow those individuals to stay in the workforce, over the last three decades, the rest of the world has surpassed us in women's workforce participation. And so when we're talking about gender parity, about gender equity in pay and in wages and in opportunity and in economic and financial security, you can't have that conversation if you don't also talk about issues like paid family and medical leave. One of the greatest contributors to wage disparities between men and women is women leaving the workforce at the prime of their careers because we don't have the policies that allow, again, those for whom caregiving responsibilities fairly or unfairly disproportionately fall on, that we don't have the policies and the infrastructure in place to guarantee that people don't have to choose between their family and their job. And so this is a critical part of that infrastructure to provide people of every gender the fair opportunity to start a family, to fulfill their responsibilities to themselves and their loved ones while also pursuing their dreams and their passions and, heck, just getting the paycheck that they need to survive. Secondly, and relatedly, we know that because caregiving responsibilities disproportionately fall on women in our society, that means that often people are pushed out of their job. They face discrimination or unfair treatment by their employer because they choose to fulfill their personal responsibilities to themselves or their family members, which means that workplace discrimination under the sort of umbrella of an individual taking leave disproportionately impacts women. And then finally, what I would say is we know that the industries that disproportionately employ women, and in particular women of color, are the industries that disproportionately do not have these types of benefits. And so we increasingly see these benefits among white-collar employees, but we don't see them among blue-collar employees. We don't see them among individuals in the service industry. We don't see them for individuals who are often on the front lines of healthcare or education. And again, those are industries, those are sectors that are disproportionately women and disproportionately women of color. And so we have to have these types of policies to guarantee that there's equity around this benefit across our economy.
As we talk about these issues, we often talk about them in this larger kind of conceptual framework. One thing we've tried to do on this podcast is talk about it from a more personal level, noting that these concepts have very personal, real-life impact on people's daily lives. And I know throughout your work on this bill, you discussed how pay leave was a personal issue for you. How did your personal story help you in developing this bill and kind of articulating its importance to people on that personal level?
You know, I'm a big believer in the fundamental truth that the political is fundamentally personal. I didn't introduce this bill. I didn't champion this bill. I didn't pass this bill solely because of my own experiences. It truly was rooted in the issues that I was hearing on the doors. Parents struggling with a new child, parents who went back to work days after giving birth, adult workers who were struggling to care for an aging parent. I was hearing this time and time again, even before COVID, when I was knocking on doors in my state Senate campaign. And I truly believe, before I get to my own personal motivation, that one of Delaware's most significant medium to long-term challenges is that we don't have enough young workers in this state. We aren't keeping them and we aren't attracting them, particularly as we're seeing population growth disproportionately among retirees. We need to make sure that we're meeting that growth with support and opportunity for young workers so that we have the workforce and the tax base necessary to support the retirees who we are welcoming into our state, to support everyone who's coming into our state, to attract businesses, to guarantee that they know that they have the workforce necessary if they locate here. And the only way to do that is to bring more young people to Delaware and to keep more young people in Delaware. And this benefit, we know, is a critical part of that decision-making process for young workers who are on the verge of starting a family about where they're going to live and where they're going to work. So I will just say all of that, but it is absolutely personal for me. As I mentioned earlier on, part of my passion for this legislation was rooted in my own experience as a caregiver myself to the person who would become my husband, Andy, during his battle with cancer. I met Andy when I was still in college, and he was the smartest and kindest and most importantly, goofiest person I had ever met. That's a critical quality in a partner for me. They have to be goofy. And I fell in love with him really quickly. about a year, a little more than a year into our relationship, Andy was diagnosed with cancer, oral cancer. And for anyone who's ever been diagnosed with cancer or who's had a loved one diagnosed with cancer, you know it is like a punch in the gut unlike anything you've ever experienced. But even from the first moments after hearing that word and getting that diagnosis, Andy and I both knew how lucky he and we were. He was lucky to have health insurance that would allow him to get care that would hopefully save his life. And I was lucky, and he was lucky as well, to have flexibility with our employers that allowed him the time and ability to get care that would hopefully save his life, and me to have the time and ability to be there by his side to care for him, to suction his tracheostomy tube and tend to his wounds after a 12-hour surgery that left him having to relearn how to talk, to be there through 6 weeks of radiation and chemotherapy that left him challenged to breathe. And that flexibility also allowed me to be there by his side when he found out that his cancer was terminal, to love him and to marry him and eventually to walk him to his passing. And up until his last breath, Andy knew how lucky he was. I know how lucky I was. And I ran for the state senate. I serve in public office because at the end of the day, I do not believe that in the most developed and the wealthiest nation on earth, that time and that ability to get care, that little bit of breathing room through the inevitable challenges of life, I don't believe that should be a matter of luck. I believe it should be the law of the land. And so it was a deep passion of mine rooted in my experience. And you know, after the Healthy Delaware Families Act passed, a member of the staff came up to me. And they had heard me talk about Andy at on the floor a little bit and in some of the roundtables. But they had just also read my book. And in that book, I recount my experiences with Andy. And the staffer said to me, "I didn't realize until finishing your book how much of this was a love letter to Andy." And in many ways it was. He was someone who not only lost his life in a way that reinforced the right to healthcare and all that that means and all that contributes to being able to access healthcare, but he also lived his life in pursuit of that principle. His life was spent expanding access to healthcare for people. That was his job. And so I was proud to do this because of what it will do for Delaware workers now and for generations to come. I was proud to do this because of the impact on families and how it will strengthen families and strengthen our economy and strengthen employers. I was proud to do this because I know it met the needs of a lot of neighbors that I was talking to, but I was also proud to do it for Andy and to write in the laws of Delaware in many ways this love letter to him.
We appreciate you sharing that story. And obviously it's a story that we all know plays out for so many other people on a daily basis, which is what makes getting this up and running so important. And that is a process that is still in progress with, as you, I think you mentioned earlier, the official start date for people to start accessing these benefits in January of 2026. Do you have a sense of how that implementation process is going and what plans are in place to make people aware that this is a benefit that they will now have?
Sure. So the Department of Labor is tasked with implementing and executing this law, and they are currently in the process of staffing out, of onboarding the technology to make this a seamless program and a seamless process for employees and employers alike. They've put forward regulations to flesh out legislation. You know, legislation, when you write legislation, it's a sort of a 35,000-foot view of the program and the challenges it's seeking to address. And the regulations are where they make policy porous and make sure that it's digestible in individual circumstances so that there's clarity in the nuances and the gray that inevitably arises and can't be fully captured in a bill. And so they've been doing that, and throughout all of this, engaging with the business community, making sure that the business community, the employer community, is aware of their responsibilities and their rights under this program, and through it, making sure that they're educating employees as well. And so there's been an ongoing statewide conversation. Similarly, as is always the case, I mean, I have a job as a legislator because legislation can always be improved upon. And there have certainly been some tweaks and adjustments that we've been working on with the Department of Labor and employees and employers to make sure that the program continues to reach its fullest potential. And so I think it's going well, but it's certainly a long process. And I am confident that by January 2025, when the contributions begin, and of course, January 2026, when access to the benefit begins, that we will have a fully operational program that, of course, will always have room for improvements, but will be providing efficiently and effectively this life-saving benefit for thousands of Delaware workers.
You mentioned earlier Delaware became the 10th state plus the District of Columbia to put this type of benefit in place, and there are other states that appear to be moving in that direction as well at this point. Are you optimistic it will continue to grow state by state, or since you are running for Congress, there's a chance perhaps some national version of this will eventually happen?
Absolutely. We're going to continue to see progress in state legislatures. I think after we passed it, after the 2022 election, I believe Minnesota may have passed a law, and other states are potentially going to do so. Pennsylvania, there's a lot of momentum despite divided government, which I think gives a blueprint and hope for ultimately a federal solution here. Because at the end of the day, most of the time on issues of this scale, while you're going to have a critical mass of states adopting it, not every state will. And the only way to guarantee that there is a truly universal national benefit and that the rules are consistent across state lines, which I think is an important goal as well for the employer community, ultimately, we deserve and we need federal action. We need a federal paid family and medical leave program. And frankly, through a federal paid family and medical leave program, we can eliminate that payroll contribution that we have within the state programs, because the federal government, as was proposed under the Build Back Better Act, can simply fund the program itself. It's not a particularly expensive program in relative terms at the federal level. And we certainly can afford to do it, especially with the proposals that President Biden had put forward in 2021 and 2022. So I would like to see us build on the progress that we've made here in Delaware and in a number of other states and provide a universal nationwide benefit.
You've been listening to the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware, with State Senator Sarah McBride discussing Delaware's paid family and medical leave law. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. The podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Delaware Humanities is the recipient of United We Stand Connecting Through Culture funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities to support a more just Delaware and related programming. And stay with us. We meet the new director of the George Reed House and Gardens in the latest edition of History Matters. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Historical Society has a new head of the Reed House and Gardens in Newcastle. Laura Earls, a longtime museum professional and historian of early American gender and material culture, has been Reed House director for roughly 3 months. She's already helped put together the one-night-only Reed House Dozen exhibit and has plans for a large revitalization of the garden. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Earls to discuss her new role and what she hopes to bring to the Reed House.
I read that you've dreamt of working in a museum like this since you were 14 years old. So this obviously is a dream fulfilled, but you've been at the helm for about 3 months now. I'm sure there's a lot of learning and processing and just getting your feet under you. And like I told you off air, I'm sure it's like drinking from a fire hose, at least at certain points. But you know, how have those first few months gone for you?
It has certainly been like drinking from a fire hose at times, but it's been really wonderful. Everyone at the Delaware Historical Society has been very welcoming. And I feel perhaps a little less overwhelmed than I might have felt if I didn't already have a bit of history with the organization. I actually, and I will promote this collaboration between the University of Delaware and surrounding institutions until I'm blue in the face. But while I was a graduate student at the University of Delaware, I was actually a graduate assistant at the Delaware Historical Society Research Library in my second year. And I also was a teaching assistant for a course that was taught by Lee Riefenberg. She was my supervisor as a graduate assistant. And she also teaches a course in archives and paper collections management for the Museum Studies certificate at the University of Delaware. So I took her course and I ended up doing some contract work on an exhibition that I had worked on as a graduate assistant. And then I ended up actually being Lee's teaching assistant for the course that I had taken a few years prior. So I had that level of familiarity with the organization, and honestly, getting this job has just felt a bit like coming home. And it's been really nice to see how the skills that I developed in graduate school translate outside of academia.
Well, there's a couple things I want to touch on there with you, but for those that don't know, Laura was most recently lead researcher and associate producer for the podcast Thing for Things, the history podcast where things happen and stuff matters. I love that name. As you just said, you've spent time at the University of Delaware. You worked in collections management and interpretation at several Delaware institutions like Nemours Estate, Winterthur, and the Delaware Historical Research Library. But how do you kind of spoke to your familiarity as far as this role goes, and it feels like coming home, but how do you feel your past experiences here helped prepare you for a role like this with the Reed House?
So I actually was very fortunate in that a lot of my early experiences as a graduate student were in house museums. So my first graduate assistant position was at the Nemours Estate. So I was working on interpretation at this house. I was doing research on, the consumer patterns of the DuPont family who lived there. And I was working with their interpretive staff to revise some of that interpretive material that went in the rooms. Room books can have information about specific objects that are set out in the room, because in a house museum, you're not going to see labels necessarily in the places that you'd hope to see them, because it's a house, it's set up like someone's home. So you may have a binder filled with entries about different objects that people can go through. So I started off doing things like that. I also spent some time in Winterthur's registration department, which was also as a graduate assistant, and Winterthur's kind of like the ultimate house museum. And over the years, through classes I've taken, I've been thinking about house museums for quite a while, especially in thinking about what I wanted my career to look like. I thought a lot about what house museums do in their communities and what they can do. I think house museums have certainly had a reckoning in the last few years, especially where there's a tendency to focus a lot of the interpretation on the families who owned the house, lived in the house for the most part. And while it's important to do that, there's so many other more complicated stories that are wrapped up in the lives of the people who not only lived in these houses, but built them, worked in them, etc.
This next question's a two-parter, but for you personally, then, and this isn't something that happens overnight, but given your background, not just as a museum professional, but as a historian of gender and material culture in early America, I should say, what are you hoping to personally bring to this position? And what does your vision for the Reed House look like as, time goes on and the months turn into years?
Absolutely. So I feel that, I mean, I tell people all the time, I don't need a PhD to do this job, but I do feel like the PhD gives me a unique perspective on how interpretation can work at the house. The house often interpretation is divided according to the families who lived here, and because I can both zoom in on individual stories, individual objects. I can also zoom out and look at the big picture in terms of how the Reed House fits into not only the Newcastle community, but Delaware, national history, global history as well. And it's my hope that, and I know that other staff here at the Reed House are really invested in doing this too, is to really tease out those stories of the people who worked here and how that all fits in with, you know, labor history, history of gender. For example, there are very complicated labor relationships in this house. There were enslaved people who worked here. There were indentured servants and there were free servants. And the Reeds used the hiring in system where they would essentially pay a fee to enslavers to for the labor of enslaved people that they themselves did not enslave. But the Reeds did employ a variety of laborers who were unfree to certain degrees. So those are stories that we've been looking into bringing more to the forefront of our interpretation, and especially in terms of gender. The Coopers and Smiths, that's one era of the house that you might not necessarily see in the rooms themselves. The Coopers and Smiths were an extended family who lived in the house for the longest out of anyone, because this house has been nearly continuously occupied since it was first built. William Cooper bought the house in 1846, and the Smiths were part of his extended family. And his nieces, one of whom is Hetty Smith, she was the last of them to live in this house until she passed in 1919, I believe. I'm still very much learning the history of this house, so take my dates with a grain of salt. But she took care of this house for a really long time. And it's very important to us that we make sure that the women who lived in and cared for this house are visible in it. And as far as material culture goes, that is, objects are a main historical source for me. I approach them like some other historians may approach documents. And I do also use documents, but we can read objects, and objects are a really wonderful way to access the stories of folks who may not have left as thorough of a written record as we would like. And that's how we can access stories of women and people of color who lived here, who worked here. And it's also a good way to get visitors really engaged, because having something visual in a tour that you're taking or going to an exhibition, that's a really great way to get people thinking critically about the past. And while it's very important that we focus on telling difficult stories in the Reed House, it was also a place where people had fun. I'll be very interested to see how balancing those things comes to fruition here at the house.
I can imagine how this fits into the bigger plans, the future plans, but I do know that you and the staff have those big plans for the Reed House. What else should we be on the lookout in the near future?
Near future, so we are we're working on our garden revitalization project, as you know. So for that, I've inherited that project. So that's one of those fire hose projects. But we are working with Foresight, which is a landscape architecture firm, and Anna Wick is currently our liaison with Foresight, and we are currently in planning stages. So overall, our hopes for this project are to increase accessibility in the gardens, thinking here of widening paths and getting uniform grading, like making sure that the brick paths are laid in like really stable bases, so it's safe for anyone to use. And we're also hoping to edit the plant palette and also create opportunities for future programming and interpretive signage. Because like I was telling you about the Coopers and the Smiths having lived in this house the longest, mainly in the mid-19th until the early 20th centuries, None of the rooms in the house are set up as if they lived there. The house is mainly set up as if the Reeds lived there. So set up like it's the early 1800s, excuse me. And there are a couple of rooms set up to look like the Lairds lived there, which was during 1920 until 1975. But what's unique about those gardens is that they are essentially laid out the same way as they were when the Coopers and Smiths lived there. They designed the gardens. So this garden is really unique survival of a Victorian garden. So we're very invested in preserving that history. And that's a space to interpret the Coopers and the Smiths and how they cared for this house. And this is also the garden project is also a really great space for us to interpret Indigenous history, especially we're planning to collaborate with Lenape, and I hope to integrate interpretation inside the house with what we've got in the gardens. So it's just one large story, both inside and outside of the house.
Thanks to Reed House and Gardens Director Laura Earls for showing us why history matters this week. And we wrap up the Green next with Enlighten Me and a trip to the University of Delaware to highlight work from student journalists there. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we return to the University of Delaware to highlight work from student journalists there, pieces produced by UD Communications students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, a longtime first aid journalist, director of UD's journalism program, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with senior Tim Beach, who examines new Gallup polling data on declining rates of happiness in the U.S.
Giggles and screams of joy come easy for children, but as time goes on, that joy is harder to come by. The Gallup World Poll measures global happiness every year and develops a world happiness ranking. What they've found? We aren't as happy as we used to be. Americans 30 and under have shown decreases in their happiness over the past 8 years. As a country, the United States recently dropped from 15th to 23rd place in our global happiness ranking. Tracy Holden teaches a happiness course at the University of Delaware.
Part of, I think, what has happened in the United States in the last, call it, 20 years or so, although it goes back further than that, is the increase in stress. And then also what we've seen is, which everyone talks, the decline in mental health. And so when you have increased stress, increased anxiety, declining mental health, you're going to wind up with a lower level of happiness. It's kind of the way it works.
It seems the most common cause of stress for college students involves the pressure of school.
Probably just because it's such a time-demanding thing and I don't have time to contribute to other parts of my life that I would like to.
That's Lily Rogers, a UD student athlete and pre-med student who plans to go on to medical school. For Carson Kammerer, a sophomore communication student, his GPA is a source of stress.
For sure grades, because I like to keep it right on the edge of like failing and passing. So like it comes right up to the last second and failing is like I don't want to fail class at all.
Holden shared that one of the biggest causes of declining happiness in younger people is the pressure to have everything figured out.
There's this sort of pressure to, I really need to have everything fixed. I need to know what I'm going to do. And there used to be more leeway for, I'll figure it out. And that everyone needs certainty when there's enormous uncertainty.
Holden draws on her own youth for some insight when teaching her happiness class.
Like I just told a class the other day, I was absolutely stupid until I was 30. I didn't go back to college or back to get my graduate degree until I was in my mid-30s. I didn't finish my PhD until I was in my 40s. It was okay. Was it perfect? No, but it was okay. So give yourself some time and grace. It will work out if you do the work.
For the University of Delaware News, I'm Tim Beach.
Thanks to senior Tim Beach for his reporting. Next, we hear from rising senior Jake Dunn, who takes a look at the rise in food delivery and why more college students are becoming delivery drivers.
Asking anyone why they chose a job will usually lead to this answer.
I needed to get some extra money.
I really needed the money.
And I really just need some extra cash.
And they each make that extra cash as delivery drivers. Nate Kuoko, a UD student who delivers for Grubhub, compared delivery driving to previous jobs he's held.
I would say it's easier, it's more relaxed, because I can create my own hours.
Nate delivers so he has extra cash, but not for what you would think. Not for groceries, rent, or even tuition.
I like to trade stock options, and it's a lot easier to do that when you have a supply of income coming in.
The delivery job goes beyond UD. Michael Van Kuren, a college student at the University of New Hampshire, gets behind the wheel to help fund more common student financial struggles.
You know, it's just super easy to sign up and commit without really having to make a huge commitment like other jobs where you have to interview and, you know, give them your availability. And, you know, I always have school and work, and I'm also on the club rugby team, so I like that I'm not scheduled to work, but, you know, I still have the ability to make money when rent is due or I need groceries.
The ease of signing up and freedom to work when you want made this career choice seem perfect, but while they are behind the wheel, other factors can determine how much they earn.
One time I didn't have service, and so the app just canceled the order, destroyed my rating, tried to contact them, and once I did, they just said, oh, can't do anything. They tried to say I ignored the order.
Back at UD, Nate says that the consistency of work isn't always the same, and this can affect how much money you're making.
The only problem I would have is sometimes I would get like deliveries like a couple hours apart during the day, which wasn't too great, and the money that you make off of it can be a little lack.
According to the latest numbers from Statista, these drivers are part of a $350 billion business. And while they might only get some pocket change, delivering seems to be a solid career choice for busy college students. For University of Delaware News, I'm Jake Dunn.
Thanks to rising senior Jake Dunn for his piece. And we close with another rising senior, Colin Seaman, who reports on the longtime construction of UD's so-called Building X, a new science lab that's set to open within the next year.
The construction continues on what's being called Building X, which is set to open within the next year. The new science lab is replacing the bygone McKinley Lab, which caught fire in the summer of 2017.
When it caught fire, I was there and I was leaving.
Carlton Cooper, a professor of microbiology and virology at the university, remembers that day like it was yesterday.
I smelled something, but you know, this is a lab environment, so you're going to smell weird things. So I didn't think anything of it, nothing of it at all. You see all these fire trucks, and they announced on the news, McKinley is on fire.
McKinley Lab was closed permanently after the chemical fire damaged the ventilation system, and Dr. Cooper was one of the first to be moved, doing so many times in the few years following.
But then we had to figure out where to go. So we end up going to Drake. And the labs had to be restructured. So every night after, I was coming to every lab section at night, moving stuff and helping the teams. It was a nightmare. We finally ended up moving into ICE, where we are now, the third floor ICE lab.
The process of replacing McKinley Lab has been a long one, taking almost 7 years to be completed. Even though Building X is seen as a major upgrade, students like junior mechanical engineering major Lauren DeSantis find it to be a hassle to navigate to the other buildings.
It's been inconvenient. So my building's Spencer Lab. And so there's construction on my building and then behind my building. So I'm excited to see the new building, but it's been 2 years of walking all the way around to get where I need to go.
Despite the mess of construction, students and faculty are looking forward to the completion of the new science lab, which will re-expand the science department and allow them to have more space to work with.
Like, my current struggles in Spencer Lab is that we don't fit in our building, and having that right there is going to be nice. It's going to look nice. It's going to be open space, hopefully study spaces of some kind.
I think it definitely is going to be better. I think the biggest plus is it'll be really beneficial for our research faculty because they have more lab space to conduct outstanding research program. And so we can take Delaware Biological Science Department to the next level.
Exactly when that will happen is still unknown. June is not possible, so for now, fall is the target. For the University of Delaware News, I'm Colin Seaman.
Thanks to rising senior Colin Seaman, as well as senior Tim Beach and rising senior Jake Dunn, for enlightening us this week with their features. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Humanities' Rachel Sheffield, University of Delaware student journalist Tim Beach, Jake Dunn, and Colin Seaman, and Delaware Public Media's senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.